Welcome to Free Thoughts from Libertarianism.org and the Cato Institute. I'm Aaron Ross Powell, editor of Libertarianism.org and a research fellow here at the Cato Institute.
And I'm Trevor Burrus, a research fellow at the Cato Institute Center for Constitutional Studies.
Today we're joined by Walter Olson, senior fellow at the Cato Institute Center for Constitutional Studies and author of many books, most recently Schools for Misrule, Legal Academia, and An Overlawyered America. Anyone who follows your blog, Overlawyered, or your work at Cato or has read your books see that you tend to spend a lot of time arguing against laws that seem pretty well-meaning. I mean, we don't want people being discriminated against. We don't – discrimination's not great. We don't want children being harmed by unsafe products. We don't want people getting fired for bad or silly reasons. So what's wrong with using the legal system to prevent these sorts of things?
Almost any law announces itself in well-meaning terms, and even the laws that seem most oppressive, if you go back and look at when they were passed, it was usually with some rationale about harm to children or harm to the helpless or protecting people from fraud or force, often libertarian-sounding rationales. But I write about law, and I write in particular about the bad things that law does to people, the ways in which it unintentionally or otherwise harms the people who are exposed to its processes and deters a lot of good activity as well as bad. And so as with libertarian analysis always, you pierce beyond the initial announced good intent of a law and you find combinations of perhaps motives that were not announced at the time for why they passed it, things that it's doing that no one expected it to do, things that are obsolete, things that have been cleverly exploited by either actors in the field or by lawyers or even by judges to accomplish something sneaky. And law is very rich in that, so much so that having written four debunking and critical books, I have enough material to go on as long as I might want, should I write more.
But at the same time, libertarians would say that the tort system, the system by which two parties sue each other for a redress of grievances against the private party, is an incredibly important factor in organizing society, right?
Well, I think part of what lends an interesting tension to my work is that I acknowledge that tort litigation is the correct legal remedy in some areas. And nonetheless, looking around at the disaster that was made of it in various areas, it makes – and you can trace this in other areas too. I mean you can in areas as simple as property law or intellectual property law, if the law is over-enforced in ways that involve penalties that are too high, in ways that allow opportunistic exploitation by the rights holder, so that I mean, think for example of the recording piracy issues, and I'll set aside for now the debate among libertarians about whether or not there is something wrong with copyright. But as assuming that most libertarians believe that outright piracy of someone's musical property is not a good idea, how did you wind up with a situation in which grandmothers whose grandchildren had downloaded a couple of songs were being sued for $200,000 each? Here you have not only a formally valid law, but even one ex hypothesi that libertarians are in favor of, leading to horrendous injustice because of the overuse of law, because somehow or other the proliferation of cells – it's terrible to use this sort of metaphors – but you know, of originally legitimate cells were allowed to expand to the point where they began doing more injustice than they were fixing.
In the realm of discrimination law, which is something that you've written about extensively, which comes up a lot for libertarians in general, but we're talking more about things like the Age Discrimination and Employment Act or even the American Disabilities Act, and there's a bunch more. In the big picture, before we get down to maybe some of these more specifically, where do those factors about laws meant to help or now hurting, where do those start coming in with discrimination laws?
Discrimination law, of course, is one of the great chestnuts about libertarianism, because it is one of the deal breakers for most of the non-libertarians out there. It is one of the things, whether you are trying to get tenure as an academic or whether you were trying to be taken seriously running for office somewhere, the career killer will be, wait a minute, you don't believe in discrimination laws. And Richard Epstein and others have written at length about some of the theoretical side of this, but almost everyone who's familiar with libertarian literature kind of understands the basics, which is libertarianism constructs its set of rights up from voluntary transactions and contract, and if it's all going to be based on voluntarism, then it is an disruptive violation of that to have forced transactions and forced contracts. And again, Epstein and others construct particular situations in which, you know, that maybe through emergencies or maybe through needed rights of way or whatever, you can get some forced transactions. But discrimination law aims to do much more than that. It aims to transform initially what seemed like relatively small portions of lives, our lives, theaters and restaurants, for example. And I'll get in a minute to why the early iterations of discrimination law seemed modest and workable, and then it expanded area by area and category by category to the point where some years ago the Supreme Court was hearing a case against United Airlines by half-blind would-be pilots who were not being hired because United said it didn't think it was safe to hire pilots whose eyesight was so bad. And no one thought this was unusual. Everyone was talking about the particular details of the ADA by which they might win or lose, but no one was stepping back and saying, wait a minute, we're talking about half-blind pilots trying to get an airline to hire them that doesn't want to hire them. So that was a long, long road, and it started with a legal landscape inherited from laissez-faire in which there were little bits here and there. For example, there were common carrier obligations sometimes, and indeed inns in the where you could stay overnight might be under a common carrier obligation.
What's a common carrier obligation?
Common carrier obligation is basically an obligation to take all comers. And that is a germ of anti-discrimination law, although obviously anti-discrimination law has grown to include much more than an obligation to take all comers. But in the case of the inns of Old England, the underlying practicality involved in the royal will that innkeepers take all comers was that you might freeze to death if you were turned down by the one inn and the next one was not for another 20 miles down the road. You might not even have a horse. So because of the dangers of particularly freezing, secondarily starving, the royal will was that this one particular category of business, but not very many others, would you know, have to open itself up in general. And there might have been similar rules on guilds and things like that negotiated. But the as laissez-faire swept through, the these were recognized as rare exceptions. And as contract law began to be seen as the generic model for all economic relations insofar as they could be, it was thought, okay, well, this is a shrinking, ever less important exception to the fact that in general we have freedom of contract between people.
And then that was in the 19th century. It still was pretty much confined to transportation and
well, what would happen then, of course, the railroad controversies were important, and there were some other controversies in which things like blocking of transportation access meant that there was a revival of interest in, look, since there is no point at all in being a farmer in some of these states, if the railroad will not deal with you, I'll put the railroads under a common carrier obligation. And so it gradually built up, but what happened, and it's it only became important in the 20th century, and indeed I think it only really mushroomed up around the interwar years, was the idea of using this type of exception to contract law to handle and initially I think the main thing that they wanted to handle was the oppression of Jim Crow. There were incidentally some other things such as can't we do something about the very systematic discrimination against Jews that were going on in you know, the American establishment institutions. But the most visible area was The South was living under Jim Crow. It was this mutually reinforcing system in which there were a lot of laws prohibiting businesses from being non-discriminatory. At the same time, there was enormous social pressure so that even when businesses were not prohibited, they tended to fall in line. And there was fear of sheriffs and there was lots and lots of different things. And the impulse was you have a system that is so self-reinforcing at so many different levels that you need to take a sledgehammer to it and you need to do something really strong and really
unprecedented, really.
Well, yeah, not depending on the subtle cooperation of the participants. Now, once again, the idea of public access to public accommodations, that will turn out to be an important term as we move on toward the obligatory wedding cake regime. But public accommodations were a pretty well understood category, which included, for whatever reason, places of public amusement like movie theaters. But otherwise, restaurants and lodgings were in there for kind of traditional reasons of it was difficult to travel if no one would allow you to eat and sleep. And so the – and I'll introduce here one of the things to keep an eye on as the law changes, because most of the common carrier obligations, most of the public accommodation rules that we've been talking about are pretty easy to enforce. They have kind of an on-off switch. You look at the movie theater's box office, you know, is there a group of black people milling around saying they won't take our money, they won't let us in? Yeah, yes, then you've got the problem you're looking for. It might go a little bit further if there's if the blocks are being steered toward one part of the audience. But in general, those laws were pretty easy to enforce with not too much confusion between the intended cases and unintended cases. And that's one reason why when the federal government did ban that category, although there was litigation for a couple of years based on resistance, based on simply scoff laws.
Yeah.
That died down and there was actually quite a low level of litigation because it was so easy to tell whether people were in compliance or not. And I said to keep your eye on that because that becomes ever less easy to enforce as you move out to areas where you don't know who's in the protected category, where you don't know whether differential treatment. And I wrote a book about employment law called The Excuse Factory, which because it's about employment law, most of it is about one form or another of employment discrimination law. And one of the things that happened in employment law was from an initial presumption to regulate the hiring and firing decision, which looked like the "do you get into the restaurant" decision, they realized that they were moving along a continuum in which people could be constructively discharged. That is, their lives could be made so unhappy as employees that it was like firing them. So you had to apply some attention to when people were constructively discharged. What about non-promotion? Well, that's like applying for the next job. So they had to scrutinize non-promotion. Well, they got to the point where the cases that I write about, the assignment of a less comfortable chair was disparate treatment because the chair that the person wanted, they said they would have gotten had they not been a member of the protected group. And
wow.
Yeah, and vacation schedules. Well, I wanted August and I was given July instead. This is now the grist of lots of employment discrimination suits, differential workplace treatment, which can mean things like I didn't get my favorite vacation slot, although I got another one 2 weeks different from it. So as the law moved along this continuum, and I'll get to the expansion of protected classes in a moment, but as it got to that, what was initially something that you could enforce with a half-time clerk.
You mean within the company of enforce?
Well, no. I was thinking about a – let's say you had a state that had passed one of these laws applying to movie theaters and restaurants and things. You know, well, if cases come along only three or four times a year where there's a real issue, it's one of these enforcement priorities that you just don't have to pay that much attention to. You know, so every so often a controversy will come up and you apply someone to it. On the other hand, once you create the possibility of suing over finer and finer differences in treatment in something like a workplace relationship, which is much like a marriage, and always has hundreds of dynamic, tugs back and forth between the parties. Then you have the need for whole departments of litigation or whole administrative agencies like the New York Human Rights Commission or whatever with large dockets of thousands of complaints because discontent about treatment at work, it is no news to anyone, is not new. It didn't come in with this issue. Lots of people are discontented about the way they are treated at work. And the so this was one of the big stories, not as important for restaurants, not as important for hotels, but very important for the workplace, is that discontents that would have been there all along, discontents that happen even when no one is a member of a protected group, people who feel done out of promotions that they worked hard for, people who know perfectly well they weren't treated fairly by their boss, they go to a lawyer, and the lawyer will put them through an interview or have them fill out questionnaires, which is partly intended to determine whether they suffered some sort of damage and whether their employer is solvent, but also will be intended to fish for any information. And even if the person comes in saying, this was an unfair dismissal and thinks at that moment that it wasn't because they were female or it wasn't because they were elderly, the lawyer patiently says, all right, you tell me about the unfair dismissal, and quickly makes a note every time anything about age or sex comes up and then begins probing, saying, well, okay, you were dismissed unfairly. Did other people goof off just as much as you and weren't fired? And the person says yes. And
because every worker thinks that, right?
Well, pretty it's much. Only human nature. Just as drivers in general nearly all believe they are above average drivers, same with the workplace, same with most of what we do in life. But the but the lawyer will be say, and they'll say, well, as a matter of fact, three other people got away with it, and they were really misbehaving just as much as what the company accused me of. And one of those people was a white male under the age of 50. And so the lawyer will begin to first comes the bad news of you may live in a state where there is no legal remedy for wrongful firing as such, which is generally still the rule, although with some exceptions. Now here comes the good news, which is you didn't realize it, but you've got a sex discrimination case, you've got an age discrimination case, or disability or a failure to accommodate your family leave needs case, and there are now so many different categories that are protected that most of us fall into one or often more of the categories.
I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, so the part of the progress of civilization has been this, learning to treat each other with more respect, learning to see each other as autonomous beings so we're not, getting our pleasure by watching people kill each other in the arena, and we're not discriminating against people on the basis of their skin color. And it's like, things get better the more we move in that direction. And so isn't this just that enforced? Isn't that, that we don't want we want to live in a better society, and that means not dismissing people because of their age, not dismissing people because of their gender. So these could be that sort of stuff
and
does exist.
And promotions too.
Don't we want to get rid of that stuff?
Here is one of the things that produces an interesting tension for libertarians, because by and large, and I know there is every type of libertarian, and you can combine libertarianism with almost every type of views, but an awful lot of libertarians are relatively pro-modern, relatively open-minded people who are delighted that we live in a society where women can now aspire to any place their talents take them, that we're, racial minority groups, gays, handicapped people have been brought into the mainstream of society in ways that are great for society because they bring in new talent and are great for the justice with which people are treated. So that means that, not speaking for all libertarians, but certainly a huge number of them, are privately cheering when that milestone is reached of someone for the first time of first American Indian who is an astronaut or whatever. And And the second thing that also figures in there is that part of libertarians' idea of how the government should run its own affairs, and this is obviously applicable in areas like not just the operation of the justice system but also government hiring for the jobs that it employs itself and many other areas of government action, is that we believe in the rule of law. We believe that the government should not be engaging in invidious discrimination, and therefore libertarians are usually there cheering on the front lines when, for example, various levels of government announced that after all they were going to hire gays, which for a long time they didn't. And so libertarians, having been in the cheering section for the social trend, having been in the cheering section for that part of the social trend that involves the government's own actions, all of a sudden drop out of the cheering section when it comes to doing it by legal force against the private sector. And again, as we know, this is one of the things that makes people run and scream at the idea of identifying themselves with the libertarian intellectual movement. But what the argument has to be is, first, I think an argument of principle, which is even sometimes – I don't want the decision for coercion, the decision to introduce a coercive new class of laws, to depend on whether or not I have to predict disaster from the immediate introduction. Disaster often doesn't happen. Sometimes the law just sits there and doesn't do very much. We need to think about how we treat each other, whether as people who we can order around as if we were somehow in charge of them, or as equal people who will sometimes believe that each other are in error. And I certainly believe when I see people who would not let me into their business that they are in error. And yet I think I'm proud of taking the position that it still should be up to them, even as I curse under my breath or laugh at them or whatever I do as I'm turned away. I like the idea that we live in such a free society where they can do that if they are so misguided, just as I can should they come around and want to do business with me, which also happens.
So it's reciprocal in some level.
Well, it is reciprocal. And one of the things about so many policy areas is that eventually the dog has his day, the goose and the gander switch positions. And you've seen this with, for example, in the complaints that have been made against gay bars for not letting in straights. And there are – oh, yes, and complaints more significant as a social issue or as an area of litigation is the question, what do you do with a private entity, whether it be a university or an employer or whatever, that says, look, I do want to engage in reverse discrimination. I believe that a particular racial group or American Indians or whatever has been so disadvantaged and has had it so long for a while that, yes, I'm going to change the ordinary admission rules. And that's part of what I think my institution should be about. That's part of my mission as far as whether a outreach based on religion or idealism, or whether it be some basis of I think that the experience of other students will be better, or the experience of our customers will be better if they meet every kind of person when dealing with our business. And one of the ironies of American debates about discrimination law is that they tend to be debates between two different groups, both of which claim total fealty to the ideal of having lots and lots of coercion. Because the typical conservative reaction in debates about discrimination law is to fasten on to the reverse discrimination issue, just like a bulldog. That's the part of the issue that they want to talk about. That's the part they feel they totally understand and are totally confident in their position. And it quickly becomes a matter of, you're not the real believer in ferociously enforced strong discrimination law norms against universities or against private employers. I'm the one who really believes it. And then the liberal responds, no. I'm the one who really believes in total ferocious enforcement. And libertarians are on the outside saying, no. Freedom is a messy thing. Freedom means when one side's getting its innings that we sympathize with the underdog that they are mistreating. fashions change, social pressures change. 20 years later, it's a different underdog. It's a different side that wants to grind out some sort of exceptional practice or push some sort of minority to the wall. And in both cases, libertarians sympathize with that minority. They say, let people interact voluntarily, and the minority and the underdog won't be squeezed to the wall as badly.
Okay, so there's this principled objection, but a lot of people don't share those principles or think that they can be outweighed by other things, that yeah, we don't want to coerce people into engaging in these transactions. But
in a perfect world, we wouldn't right. want to do that, but we
but
have this problem.
We have these problems. These people are behaving poorly. We want to stop it. So what's wrong beyond that? I mean, what's the worst that happens is someone, you know, they get dismissed and they sue in court and the court finds that they weren't dismissed wrongly.
I can get into the horrors of litigation. I'd kind of rather save that for a minute because you raise wider and I think equally interesting questions about can't you be a little bit consequentialist about this, or
sure.
aren't libertarians bound to lose if they aren't consequentialist? And you know, in a way, I think you're right, which is libertarians clearly have been losing ground and have been on the defensive on this for decades, and it is in part because people want a little more consequentialist meat on the bone instead of just a principled argument where they strongly emotionally engage with some of the people that are being protected. And I'd say a couple of things about that. One is that this is all rather new, and we don't actually know where it's heading. We know that it doesn't seem to have been stable to stop with the three or four groups that were initially protected, which means that from the standpoint of defending the practicalities of these things, it isn't just the 1960s voting rights or public accommodations law they've got to offend. It is the wild stuff that is going on in the fringes of the ADA, where they are beginning to agitate now for making everyone's website accessible to blind and deaf web browsers, which means that you will have to take down your personally published diary website if it does. And, yeah, totally crazy. But again, you know, this is a moving target, and we should not allow the favorite move of simply picking the beginning of it as if it were stably stopping there and saying, why couldn't you let this happen? What has happened is that it's snowballed to a point where the practical results are pretty astounding. We mentioned litigation and the cost of litigation, and in part because the federal judiciary has veered in a direction of being less pro-plaintiff than was probably expected to be. Employment discrimination litigation is only a leading headache for business managers rather than completely having swallowed up all of our attention and turned into the national pastime. But it is a major, major drag on the workplace in many ways, certainly for those who are involved in it. Employment litigation is a horrible thing in which reputations are attacked, both of the person suing and people, the co-workers. Careers are destroyed, very often the person who files the lawsuit, and very often other people who in the course of the lawsuit are accused of terrible things and find that their careers permanently stall out. It is really a quite a bad way of getting, quote, compensation to anyone, because if people get involved in employment litigation, they tend not to earn as much afterward, and yet the amount that they get is years later, and the lawyers take a lot. So it's a lousy, lousy system as far as anything we would set up as a kind of insurance to protect our own economic interests. And it's a lousy system, I would argue also. You know, most cases fail at one level or another. And defenders of employment discrimination law say, you know, see, this proves that it's not really very onerous because defendants win most cases. This proves that we need more of it because judges are so hostile. They never acknowledge that perhaps the reason most cases are losing is that most cases really were not all that well-based. And but that's what they would hear from a lot of judges talking in their bricks if they could talk freely about it. So you have great claims made for the social idealism of this sector of litigation, but if you look at the actual people that are touched by it, you find a whole bunch of disasters and not that many big successes.
It also seems like one of the things libertarians could be there to remind people with the principles that undergird private discrimination is that the way to basically try and solve these questions is not to constantly go to government. It's, you know, government erodes civil society in the way we don't just keep adding traits to Title VII of the Civil Rights Act and there's no feasible stopping point. Oh, they have a beard, or they have red hair, or they have two different colored eyes. When do you stop? What can you discriminate on and what you can't? And why don't we just talk about this like civilized human beings as opposed to going to court?
Well, and in fact, just about the best advice you can give people in the workplace is find a way to make it work out even if people are being somewhat unreasonable, because that's – you're going to find the same thing wherever you go. You know, there are some people behaving somewhat unreasonably. Find a way to work it out without turning it into a mini civil war. But that's not necessarily the message that the law sends when it extends this doctrine into more and more areas. Now, there's another consequentialist argument that I wanted to throw in before we say enough of consequentialist arguments. We don't need to worry about those anymore. But the one that I find kind of fascinating is the we know that several of the protected group categories, race and religion in particular, but you can you could find others, are things over which people have fought civil wars, not just in the United States, but also, you know, turn to Eastern Europe, turn to the Middle East, turn to much of the world, and you find that people are burning down each other's houses and
worse that, and that, murdering
and,
each other,
and worse, and that, and so the argument, I think one that we should not dismiss out of hand, because I think it may have more mileage as a consequentialist argument. But the argument that I've heard is, look, if we can be like countries A, B, and C that have different religious communities that in principle should be at each other's throat but manage to work out an arrangement, and they have this set of laws, the Malaysians versus the ethnic Chinese, or the Lebanon, believe it or not, used to be offered as an example of this sort of thing, where the law carved things up between Christians and Muslims and several other groups. Lebanon, understandably, is no longer used as an example of that. But I'm not sure it was because of the internal collapse of Lebanon's way of doing it. But again, as Hobbes could have told us, as many of the great classical liberals could have told us, if the alternative to a little bit of coercion is having a whole civil war, then that's actually a better consequentialist argument than some poor person will have to trudge down the road and find a different job. And here's where I would say, consider that this is not a step from not having the law to having the law. It is getting on to a road in which we are moving involuntarily through its expansion in directions we know not of. No one can really predict where this stuff will be in 10 years, because no one 10 years ago would have predicted where it is now. Where is it going to lead us when there is more of a collision with religious liberty principles? Where is it going to lead us when groups that appear to have been brought into more harmonious relations by it, maybe some lawyer discovers a new way. And one of the things about litigation in an active area is that lawyers are always discovering new ways to deploy principles. Reparations lawsuits, some of them based on theories not unlike these. If reparations begins to look as if it's going to be taken seriously. Last time it did, about 10 years ago, I'm convinced one of the reasons it shrank from public sight was 9/11. But another of the reasons was that it was an extraordinarily polarizing issue which threatened racial progress, basically, because it meant that as one pollster put it, the people who were against reparations were so upset that sometimes it was difficult for them to continue with the survey. Now, some of these, and it's very hard generalized. Some of these laws have been introduced and have been followed by a lessening of tensions and exactly the kind of social peace that you would hope. Others have been introduced and have led to the emergence of tensions between groups that had never been particularly upset with each other. Because we don't know, humility suggests that we not buy a ticket to a fast-moving train to an unknown destination.
So there's these harms to – if you enter into these things, it can be really hard on you. The litigation can be long and expensive and your reputation can be destroyed, and similar with the employer. So it's – it can be very bad for the people immediately involved, but are there larger effects, larger negative effects from having anti-discrimination law?
Or certain – maybe some of the anti-discrimination laws?
Well, yeah. We can get into the the backfire effects, and one of the things that keeps this an ever fresh topic is that they, it's always different from one area to the next. The effect of sex discrimination law isn't anything like the effect of race discrimination law, and the effect of age and disability are yet completely different. So that to take one of the chestnuts that I use when after the passage of laws protecting race, the rate of black male participation in the workforce declined. After the passage of laws protecting gender, female participation in the workforce increased, although it had been increasing anyway. In the case of disability, it plunged, and in the case of age, and I come around to age because I find age to be a good entry point for the idea of unintended consequences in these things. When age was added, and you know, I'm not just being snarky when I say that we have not had a civil war based on age that we had to atone for. In another sense, of course, there has always been a civil war based on age between people and their parents, but but people keep changing identity between
the participants change. Yes.
Yeah, but between the combatant classes, but economically. This was an extraordinarily bogus thing to add because the law in various ways had held women down. The law had certainly held blacks down. That's the paradigmatic case. But the law had not held old people down generally. If anything, it had arranged itself in their favor in various ways.
Well, so before this is the Age Discrimination and Employment Act, which was passed in what year?
Oh, when would it have been passed? Like the 70s.
I think it was 71, yeah, 72. And then what does it actually say? It says you cannot –
Well, the Age Discrimination Act, at first it makes a cutoff of age. You can't – at age – 24-year-old can't sue over the hiring of a 22-year-old. You have to be over a particular threshold at which you qualify. And unlike almost all of the others, it's not negative. Discrimination in favor of an older person is okay. So they recognized in doing some of these things that it wasn't like the other categories. Basically, they were making it up out of whole cloth. But among its other effects, it abolished for all but a few exceptional cases, what was miscalled mandatory retirement and what I prefer to call automatic retirement, which is a rule within an organization saying that at age 65 or whatever, you will become a retiree. And that had lots and lots of unintended effects. I think they were unintended. But getting back to the rationale, you know, old people in the workforce make more money, are richer, have higher level positions, et cetera, et cetera. Where's the discrimination? Well, the argument was, well, only a few of them win the lottery of getting to be the CEO, and it can be hard toward the end of a career to stay, which is also true, as we were to find out, much more so after they passed the law. But so what has happened to the labor force participation? Again, the first statistic that I turn to for whether a group was helped or harmed are more of them able to work for pay, or are more of them staying out of the workforce, presumably because they're not seeing attractive opportunities. That has plunged for people in the exact category that was intended to be benefited by a discrimination law, and especially for the subgroup of older male executives. They are the ones who are most thrown out of work empirically. They're the ones whose employability has plunged in the last few decades.
And can we take a step back and talk about why that is the case? How does this law make employing them less attractive?
And is this the same – I mean you said that the laws – in every instance these things are different, but you said we saw plunging rates with
the disabled,
blacks
too.
And disabled, but not with women. So is there something tying these together?
In the case of race and disability, there are what the statisticians would call confounding factors. In particular, taking the case of the disabled, they were tinkering with disability benefits at the same time in ways that discouraged employment. And if the ADA were doing all that it were promised, because the ADA was rationalized on the grounds that it would pay for itself by bringing more disabled people into the workforce, we know that that was false. We know that it plunged instead of jumping. Figuring out how much of that plunge might have been due to the law is very difficult because the law was changing in ways that discouraged employment through Social Security disability, the architecture of that program. But the in the age case, there weren't all that many. There were certain changes in the Social Security program, but it's a much cleaner experiment of they changed that thing, and the employment situation of people toward the end of their careers, especially in corporate America, has never been the same since. And nearly everyone agrees that it's not as good, that the old corporate loyalty thing of, gee, they used to give you a gold watch and a goodbye ceremony. Well, think, why is it that they don't give you a gold watch and a goodbye ceremony and you feel the you know, the room full of love of everyone you've worked with clapping for you? The reason is that used to happen at age 65, and they made it illegal for it to happen at age 65. The preferred method, and I'm boiling down a whole literature in the law reviews, is let the person stay until you can prove them incompetent, which means that every severance after age 65 now implicitly carries a message, hi, we've found you incompetent. We're cutting you off because specifically you individually just aren't good enough anymore. Well, great. Yeah, so much better for morale. However, it doesn't tend to reach that point because large corporations realized some time ago that they could, did not want to face potential individual litigation from every person. They would do buyouts instead. And so they would come along every 5 years or every 10 years or whenever there was a recession, and they would say, we're having a buyout and there are these very complicated rules, and if you don't take it within the 30-day or 60-day window, you might be fired involuntarily, but we're not making any promises to anyone. And they could get people to leave, and so long as all of the departures were voluntary, it was okay to have all of your older employees leave at the same time. So ways were found around it, very artificial, expensive, ridiculous ways that sometimes result in companies losing people that they hoped would stay because of the way that they couldn't really control the buyout. But in the meantime, what happens to the person who, for whatever reason, is age 57 or age 61 and wants to make good use of those last few years of high-level skills? Well, at this point, they become a litigation risk because, wait a minute, he's 64 years old and he wants to apply for a job with us, and if A, if it doesn't work out, or B, if ordinary results of change in aging mean that in 6 years we don't feel that he's as good, you mean we might have to have an age discrimination suit by a high-paid manager. And, of course, high-paid managers were the group that filed by far most of the ADA – or the age suits. I don't mean to say numerically most of them, but very, very disproportionate to their representation in the workforce. The lawsuits were coming from well-educated, well-paid, mostly middle managers because CEOs had their own severance contracts.
So they just won't hire someone at who's at 64 because they're afraid of the lawsuit.
Yeah, and
but isn't that against the law too?
It is officially against the law, but it's an unenforceable part of the law because so long as you don't let anything on paper, so long as you don't have any of the telltale things such as asking when someone went to college or anything – you can't ask any age-related questions, and there are some surprises and landmines and pitfalls, but every HR department is briefed by its lawyers as to the questions you can't ask. And once you've remembered all the things you're not allowed to ask in the job interview, then basically it's very hard to enforce the laws against age discrimination on the hiring side. You know, it's somewhat easier if companies are refusing on the more traditional categories, because then you'll just notice the overall statistics. But it's harder to notice overall statistics when 64-year-olds are not getting offered jobs.
And then you mentioned this thing at the end there that we haven't really broached on either. It might be a whole new topic, but disparate impact as another element of this. So we've been talking about intentionally discriminating. The general idea of, oh, you're a woman. I don't like women. You're not getting a promotion. You're not getting hired. That's the thing that, you know, a lot of people think is wrong, whatever. But there's another thing where the effects of neutral policies have discriminatory
right.
outcomes.
And that has been the sad legacy of former Chief Justice Warren Burger, who'd went along with disparate impact in the early years in an employment case. And we're now having the build-up to a Supreme Court showdown about whether or not they can use it in the housing area. But just a few of the areas where it turns up. For example, fire departments and strength tests or agility tests or speed tests for rescuing a body from a second floor. These have been relentlessly attacked for disparate impact. You know, generally the case is the fire department would be happy to hire any women
who could pass the test.
Who could pass the test, but women would typically do extremely poorly at carrying a 250-pound dummy down a ladder and tests of that sort. So the tests had disparate impact, and as a result, because of the way the law sets up so as to make it anything with disparate impact a broad litigation target, you can't always beat it, but. You know, the law arranges to make it very easy to shoot at it. Courts would strike down around the country, not always, but in many instances, would strike down these strength tests. And this was very bad news for the public services because whether you were in the sanitation department, for example, and the test was changed so that you could simulate dragging empty garbage cans back to the truck. Well, of course, that's one task that you can give to some people on a sanitation force. But if you have to hire all of your sanitation people based on the ability to drag an empty can, you will find that you know you're not as well off as if you have a team all of whom can carry a full can. Mm-hmm. And likewise with police, you know the big impact with this the endurance and strength tests with police was not so much changing the number of women on the force, because there are a lot of police jobs for which women are actually fine because they do not require upper body strength and different things. It is that you can't keep the puffing men who can't run the mile very fast. You can't discriminate in favor of the highly fit men when it was just man against man. You know, and likewise for all of these other areas, the disparate impact is so extraordinarily irrational. I was a bit unfair to conservatives earlier when I said that they only focused on reverse discrimination because, to their credit, they've done a lot of focusing on disparate impact too. And it turns up in the current very hot controversy over criminal records in hiring, because one of the big initiatives of the Obama administration EEOC, mirrored by movements in various cities and states around the country, Baltimore and Los Angeles and others, is so-called ban the box. And the argument is because inquiring about criminal records or using that as part of the decision process, also bad credit is another thing, much the same way, it indisputably has a disparate impact because minority applicants are more likely to have trouble in those areas. Again, they are saying it has disparate impact. They won't ban it completely, but you have to jump over a bunch of hurdles of proving direct job relevance. If someone has a conviction for embezzlement and you're hiring for an accountant, then yes, you can cover it, but not when I wrote this up, the example in Wisconsin, which had one of the earliest laws covering this, was a recycling plant could not that discovered that a very notorious child murderer had turned up in its payroll, and that this was just creating a sensation of among other employees and among the occasional groups that would visit the plant, although it, as a recycling plant, it didn't have too many outsiders. But it was just sensational. And the Wisconsin system said, having committed a spectacular child murder is not relevant to the tasks you were going to have them do. You can't you owe them a lot of back pay. And the so this is you know, it's very frustrating because it means that more and more of the things that are indisputably relevant to the quest for the best employees are kept off limits, and these may also backfire because it is believed in many HR circles that if you're not allowed to ask questions about an area, you may simply steer away from it. For example, if there's a gap on a resume and you have circumstantial evidence, oh, the person may have been serving time, but you're not allowed to ask. It's much easier to assume the worst, especially if you're liable for the misbehavior, than if you can say, please tell me what was happening to you in 2008. And then, you know, maybe the person has a fighting chance to say, you know, it was just a drug possession thing. You know, I've been perfectly fine in my probation. All the things you can't ask about, but that might set the employer's mind at rest. They've seen the same thing on disability and employment, because there again you've got a case where the labor force participation rates plunged, and you know, so a lot of people wondered, you know, why did they plunge? But one of the things that comes out of the HR world is someone limps into the office and they've obviously got something that makes them different from the normal physically, and the ordinary course of small talk in getting to know a friend, and certainly the ordinary course in seeing whether they can do a job, would be something like, you know, tell me about how you lost your arm, tell me about what life is like and how you get around it. Can't ask those questions. You can have certain highly artificial ways of asking. One of the duties of the job is to X. With appropriate accommodation, could you do X? And you've got to really be just that formulaic, and then you kind of have to take their word for it, even if you suspect that they're not giving you the right answers, instead of just having a give and take, which would put some people's minds at ease. And again, with handicap discrimination, very, very hard to police the hiring side. So you wind up with what the Obama administration has just announced, which is for federal contractors, there are going to be quotas because it's so hard to police the hiring thing. I think it's 7%. I'm going by memory. But federal contractors, which includes most large companies, are going to have to check their books, and there's two levels. I think they've got a smaller number for more severely handicapped people and a larger number for people who have things that you wouldn't even necessarily know are disabilities, but you find out when you look at the paperwork.
I want to ask about causes for why things have gotten this way. I mean, to some extent, the incentives for certain groups are pretty easy to see. So for the trial lawyers, for the people who are going to be suing about all this, broadening these laws, giving more grounds for litigation makes a lot of sense because it's more money in their pockets. And certainly for some of these protected groups, arguing for more protection sounds good, although as you've said, they often end up getting hurt by this, by lowering employment rates or whatever else. But there's another group that you've argued is a driver for a lot of this really bad law, and that's law schools. And I'm just – Trevor and I have – are not too long ago, both of us went through law school. So I'm just curious, how are law schools contributing to
Well,
these
let's
problems?
Talk about both law schools and trial lawyers or the interest of the litigation profession because they're both big stories. And you mentioned that it was different from group to group. And identity politics, obviously there's huge tie-in between the aspirations of Black America and these laws and a you know, and some fit between the aspirations of ambitious women and these laws, and almost no fit with age, for example. And you can find an identity politics movement among the disabled, but you just can't find one among old people. And A strong law was passed anyway. Pregnancy discrimination, where did that come from? There is no identity politics to speak of. I guess there's mommy blocks. But by and large, identity politics cannot explain many of these expansions. And some of the expansions are better explained by the fact that you have a coherent, well-organized group that wants to expand these laws in general, wants to find new areas. The labor movement, although sometimes ambivalent about the laws, generally in things like pregnancy discrimination, they see an area to get more leverage against employers. In some of them see them as add-ons, and generally the feminists believed in adding on things like family marital status, although the actual impact of marital status as a category, it's not at all clear that it's pro or anti-feminist. But again, it sounds like it should be an interest of feminism. And they know that they're in favor of more supervision and more opportunities to have disputing. And some of this is, I'm afraid to say, an economic interest to the fact that this is a large area of litigation, which has in common with most areas of litigation that the plaintiff side is extraordinarily intent on lobbying for expansive law, and the defense side, by non-contrast, is not particularly well organized, because if you took away the law, they would all lose their livelihood. And so you have a lot of pushing from the one side and not particularly effective pushing most of the time, unless it's something so obviously impractical that they feel in good conscience, look, there's going to be enough other things to dispute. We can be against this crazy application. But the and one of my examples on that was when they were doing one of the many overhauls by which Congress has expanded this. And if you go back and look, the Supreme Court has often interpreted the law in ways that tend to constrain it, with the ADA particularly, but there were some other areas in which they simply wouldn't allow all of the ambitious legal theories. And usually what happens was within 3 years, Congress comes around and writes some omnibus expansion, reversing all the Supreme Court decisions, saying, yes, you can sue over all of those things, and while we're at it, here's 10 more. Mm-hmm. And in one of those rounds, while Ted Kennedy was still in the Senate, there was wheeler-dealer negotiations with the business lobby as represented by Republicans in Congress, and it had to be decided they couldn't get everything past the Republicans. What would they give up? And they kept legal fee provisions, which benefited the bar at the expense often of their own clients, while throwing overboard a couple of substantive things that would have been of very considerable interest to groups of clients but would not have been of as much interest to the profession. So you can't dismiss the interests of those administering the system as one of the drivers. But let's get to the law schools, because the law schools are independently, and aside from any self-interest in money flowing in, the law schools are romantically involved with this area of law. They pine for it.
They gaze longingly into its eyes. They
moon at it, and they they are lovelorn when it threatens not to pay them attention. And when I write about these areas, I have often tried to master the law review literature, at least the major, the Matterhorns and the Mont Blancs of the Alpine landscape. With employment discrimination law, no person in the world could ever have read all of the law review articles, because it is such an extraordinarily popular area to write about. And it's not just the employment discrimination literature. It's also, feminism and bankruptcy law. It's also disability and, eminent domain. I mean, it's an effort to get, and you can treat this as, well, identity politics is strong in the law schools, and we know that, and this is identity politics' way of making itself felt with the rule against perpetuities and my group. Beyond that, it is also It's ambitious in that it's not just all ivory tower stuff. It's very much aimed at let's get going here to actually develop new causes of action and larger damages. And you know, there is a practical tie-in that there isn't
social
always.
Justice through the law.
Yeah, yeah. So you have all over the universities are law journals devoted to the identity politics areas and projects and professorships and so forth, not all of which engage with discrimination law, but it makes this enormously large and thriving body of operations, which means that when one of these Supreme Court decisions, for example, comes out, the academic commentary on it will be more or less unanimous. You may find a couple of Federalist Society types saying that the Supreme Court did right by being skeptical, and you will see a mountain, an unreadably large mountain of credentialed commentary from the other side. Now, to me, this isn't just we're getting at some of what makes this such a tough question for libertarians, because I'm not the first person to notice that libertarians getting tenure in the legal academy tend to be specialists in things like securities law real property or
business corporate law.
Yeah, and on the other hand, they are calculating, I think, quite correctly, that any pieces they might wish to write on identity politics and discrimination topics should be saved for after they get tenure, and perhaps after they, have good moats fences around their offices against student sit-ins. And we get back to the fact that this isn't just some peculiar growth only at law schools, although its growth at law schools has been very much fed by things like Ford Foundation programs of massive grants specifically to encourage law schools to develop in these areas. And the Ford Foundation has also been doing the same thing with history departments and with sociology departments. So it's the university more generally. I don't blame it all on the Ford Foundation. It clearly has this life of its own. I don't think I'm being too grandiose when I say that it is the substitute for religion in some ways of what makes people believe that the public good is the public good. If you collar someone not just necessarily in a liberal university town but increasingly a lot of other areas of life and say, I have only 10 seconds. Please name a legitimate function of government. Please name something that we really need the government for, something that would just be terrible if we didn't have the government. All previous ages would have said, well, someone's got to arrest the burglars and the footpads and the people who would break into our house. And you might have gotten other areas at different times. And I'd see if I'm wrong. Go up to 10 people and ask that question and see if at least half of them don't say, there would be all this discrimination. Who would stop discrimination otherwise? So for libertarians, this is an issue to think about over the long term, because it's much more central to people's self-image of being a good person than most of the functions of government that we might argue about.
For people who are interested more in this topic, where can they find you online?
My blog is overlawyered.com, launched in 15 years ago and in recent years published by the Cato Institute. I'm on Twitter, both at overlawyered and at Walter Olson. That's OLSON, no hyphens or anything. And I'm active on Facebook.
Thank you for listening to Free Thoughts. If you have any questions or comments about today's show, you can find us on Twitter at Free Thoughts Pod. That's Free Thoughts, P-O-D. Free Thoughts is a project of Libertarianism.org and the Cato Institute and is produced by Evan Banks. To learn more about libertarianism, visit us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.